My name is Andrew Stewart, and I am a member of the Rhode Island Media Cooperative. 2016 has proven to be one of the most eventful years in recent memory. One element that is particularly taking up a substantial level of interest is the issue of minority rights. In a year where groups like Black Lives Matter have been making headlines on a weekly basis, it seems that a great level of political activity and attention is being paid Black and Brown people and their votes during this election. In order to better understand this group, I have spent the past year talking with voters across America, asking them about both the election and what they hope to hear talked about the day after they cast their ballot. We now present to you the results of those conversations. Mike Ruggio is the director of Rhode Island Jobs with Justice, located in Providence. So, Mike, the Black Lives Matter movement has gone leaps and bounds over the past year and a half, 2 years, in a direction and trajectory that, to my mind at least, seems to indicate they are at the same point where the Black Panthers were at in their zenith. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think I've ever heard that. That's an interesting take. Yeah, I can see that. I think the difference is, probably the major difference that I can kind of spot is that the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense kind of evolved with a pretty sophisticated political program right from the outset. Like, the evolution is very, very fast, but it's also really intentional. And I think that in Black Lives Matter, I'm not speaking for, as somebody who has participated in and organized with, but not as a representative of.
Absolutely.
I think the development is really different in a lot of really kind of meaningful ways. I think Black Panther Party was really kind of rooted in nationalist anti-colonial struggle. So the language of that was really kind of present everywhere. You had the Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh who were actively nationalist and actively communist and had a really pretty sophisticated analysis of U.S. and imperial power. Then you had Cuba, which was acting as a very loud and very public counter-argument and also a real scold against segregation. You had lots of left parties like Patrice Lumumba, Anil Clark Cabral, and other, like a pan-African movement that had kind of a shared language in the moment. All of it was critical of capitalism and all of it was critical of imperial power. I'm not an expert on this, but that's what it seems like to me, is that the language that was kind of swirling around the world in that kind of revolutionary moment of the 60s had everyone speaking on close to the same language. Right. So like the anti-communist consensus that the United States had used the communist expressions, right? Like they as making their counterpoint, saying like, well, do you want to live in a world where you're not rewarded for hard work? And for Black folks, we've never been rewarded for hard work. So, so the argument falls flat pretty quickly. So, and there's a great deal of skepticism. So like when you're thinking about it that way, there's a pretty solid understanding of economically critical and socially critical language that was used at the time. So, I mean, like, I guess probably the bigger aspect to that is shifting of real left-wing thought from kind of Western, like a white Western version of it to a more colonized people's version, which I think actually has much more depth at the end of the day. So like, you know, people always think of the, and this is probably not the best example, that's one that just kind of pops in my head, as of the Palestinian Liberation Organization as kind of like this really kind of specific semi-single issue group, but they actually had a much larger anti-colonial and anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist idea that was attached to it. The IRA in Ireland also carried a lot of that thought. There was a sharing of these kind of revolutionary ideas. And I think Black Lives Matter, the reaction that happened from authorities in Western states and authoritarian states in the colonial world was thorough, and it has been nearly feeling like pretty complete. Capitalism is ascendant. Criticism of capitalism is really considered crazy because there is no alternative, and if you cite any potential alternative, you're out of your mind. Concepts of colonialism are seemed dated now, or not now, but I mean that kind of had been, and in Western leftist thought, concepts of identity were supposed to be secondary. And that is something that minority groups cannot give up. It's not I don't have the right to give up my identity and subsume it to a different politics. The politics have to fit my identity, not the other way around. And I think that Black Lives Matter, with the leadership of the queer women founders in particular, center that better than almost anything. And so we see a much more thoroughgoing and inclusive policy coming out of it. It's fascinating. And I think it's also one of the most hopeful things I've seen in a very long time. It's also, you know, arguably for a movement that started in a very, very small, seemingly very small struggle, has translated meaningfully around the world quickly. I don't know. It's like, it feels like an advent of a moment.
Right. So there was a conference at the beginning of the year in Philadelphia at Temple, and Tony Montero, who is a Black scholar that's done a lot of scholarship on Du Bois and what he calls the Black radical tradition, he did a lecture called The Black Radical Tradition as the Socialist Alternative. And what he proposed is roughly akin to what you just mentioned, where you replace what are essentially a bunch of white European men as the figureheads of Marxism or Leninism or socialism, and it put in for those roles people like Du Bois and Fanon and the different figures of the Global South and the resistance movement in America, from the communist movement up to the civil rights movement and beyond, as a sort of politics that could be the real beginning of a change. What are your thoughts on that idea?
I think that's one of the most, that's like one of the most important things that can happen. So like, we're still, like, when you get right down to it, and I, you know, as somebody, I do not shy away from being or identifying as a person who believes in communism. But the reason that I come to that comes from a place that, you know, I've always, Marx, even though he can provide a really great analysis, or Bakunin, or any of those Northern European thinkers, can provide a really kind of good foundation or whatever. Like, they did translate something really meaningful, and I don't mean to diminish that, but at the same time, it never sat really well, right? So, like, it was always a little bit of a shoehorn fit that when you think about the societies, colonized societies in particular, like take Australian society, right, or Aboriginal society, the Native Australian society, is a incredibly rich, beautiful, communal, arts-based, like they centered on something very, very different than what other societies centered on. And that is an ideology, and that is a practice at the same time. Like, to imagine that it comes from someplace, there's a decision that the members of that society made to participate in that society, the same way that we make decisions to participate in our society. They have the same imagination, they have the same vision, they just center a different value than traditional Western value. And could very well be rooted in material, it could be rooted in dialecticalism, it could be, I mean, there's a lot of room to kind of make them fit. But I would much rather look to or seek out elders and examples like Fanon or the slave rebellions of Brazil, which organized these incredibly complicated societies that were sharing-based and matriarchal and beautiful, and that their political economy and their social economy is something that I desperately value. And it's also my model of what is possible.
Right.
And so I think, like, as much as Marx was reacting to, like, this rapidly changing and super destructive world that he was witnessing and was trying to figure out a way to both mitigate the damage but also kind of lift himself up or lift his people up out of a specific thing, same with Bakunin, is that it is only existing in reaction to, and there is a proactive version of the world that was existent in the 1840s that was actually the majority of the planet. Not saying like there was something romantic or beautiful about it, but there is also, we didn't get to know. So it's very possible that the intent that when slaves rebelled in Southern Virginia, for example, they knew that duplicating a slave society was not something desirable. And that is a capitalism, that's a critique of capitalism.
Right.
So I'm going to them. Mm-hmm. I'm going to the Maroons. I'm going to the Geechee people, and I'm going there to look for my political economy, but I am definitely going to do it thinking about the other parts of the political world. And that's going to include Marx, and that's going to include Bakunin as well.
Right. And my point has been, in recent times, I've been thinking about Marx as somebody who was active in the abolitionist movement and trying to add something to the radical abolitionist movement rather than trying to start something else.
Yeah, I think that's really kind of important to remember. And I think people kind of forget that about Marx had a real thorough and serious critique. So for an enslaved person, it doesn't even have to be an enslaved person. For somebody who is imprisoned in some way, who is choice is taken away from them and their future is denied or whatever, that is not a desirable position. And there's a recognition of immediately of how undesirable that position is. I mean, among African Americans or enslaved, captured African Americans here, suicide rates, forced abortions, running away were endemic. There was a culture of resistance right at the beginning. So abolition starts at the person who needs to abolish the system. Marx recognized that. And I think that was something that other abolitionists did not recognize. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that's really important. And also because of Marx, and I mean, again, don't pretend to be an expert at this. This is like from, my seventh grade reading of version, or the best I could do. Is as far as I could tell, like Marx thought about that other philosopher, Hegel.
Right.
who said that the master's brutality was necessary because of the resentment of the creative power of the slave, and that the world is actually created by the enslaved and not by the masters. That it was an inversion mm-hmm. that caused so much conflict. And I think Marx recognized that in slavery, and he also recognized that in gender dynamics.
Right.
And I think that makes him a shining light of thought. I don't think people thought that deeply about it up until that moment. I mean, women did, and enslaved people did, but the people that were doing the subjugating and the enslaving purposely did not.
Right.
And I think that's a really significant thing. So I don't ever mean to diminish. I think he recognized that anytime there had to be revolutionary thought, it had to be inclusive. Otherwise, it was going to duplicate the existing structure. I think that also is something. Right. I think that's why I love the anti-colonial struggle so much.
Right. And one of the interesting things that strikes me about his writings is particularly the amount of praise and outright adulation he has for Lincoln. He writes on the letterhead of the First International, the most laudatory letter you could possibly envision for Lincoln, congratulating him on his reelection. And it's not clear if he understood what Lincoln's Indian policy was, but he did understand that Lincoln was a capitalist lawyer who had represented trust and was not exactly John Brown.
Considering where the United States was, and considering what Lincoln did, yeah, I mean, I think Marx was, you know, so it's the United States doesn't have a history of publicly thinking very deeply about any subject going back forever. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, like even, you know, I mean, I know this is going to, some people are probably going to hate the idea of it, but like the pretty words that Thomas Jefferson wrote were not really all that, I mean, they're kind of trite at the end of the day. I mean, it's like, these are sort of like, where you know. So like deep thought wasn't something that, there weren't, like John Adams arguably was an intellectual. Lincoln was an intellectual, like even if he was a capitalist lawyer, even if he had done, and he did commit genocide and atrocity against indigenous peoples, even if he did make horrible compromises regarding slavery, I mean, he made a series of really ruthless and brutal decisions that destroyed a huge amount of lives. He was a thinker at the end of the day, and he was one of the few. And I think considering the world that Marx lived in, where it was royalty almost everywhere, and somebody like Lincoln, you're going to encourage the nascent brain, not discourage the new brain, right? Like, he much better than the inbreds of European royalty.
Exactly.
And also Lincoln did center labor pretty consistently in many of his speeches, even if he did undercut it through railroad policy and Indigenous American policy and among African Americans, not valuing that at all. He did say that labor should be primary above capital, which is a deeply revolutionary thought. And he would probably have considered himself some sort of a Marxist in some way because of that. I mean, unitary state, he believed in the rightness of working class people. Like, there's just a lot of, you know, Lincoln, maybe they were like the American Lenin.
Mm-hmm. So, in this sense, I want to talk about what you think can be expected on the local and national level as we move forward, because it seems after November, there's still going to be a world where things, if it seems apparent to me, things are actually not going to be getting better anytime soon in terms of economics, environmental, social, political, and international issues. So what do you think would be things to expect or would not be surprised by if Black Lives Matter and the movement for Black Lives goes in that direction?
So you're right. I mean, I don't think there's not a whole lot of room for optimism. In general, I think that we're you know, I say that, but then I'm saying something I actually don't believe right on the surface. There is a tremendous amount of room for optimism, and it's difficult to not see what's possible in this. So, I'm trying to look it up because I don't have it. I had it pretty close. The policy positions of BLM, many of them are attainable. Mm-hmm. You know, none of them, I think, are so far outside of what's, you know, I mean, they're in no way should they be considered not revolutionary, right? Like, these are the things that are being said are, you know, divestiture, reparations, community control, economic justice. These are traditional demands inside the African American community and the indigenous community, going back to .. Like, you can pick a moment. I don't think anyone has ever seen it broken down into such a clear platform with suggested policy positions that can either be adopted or not. All of it is framed in such a way that the language centers on the African-American community and the Black community, but is totally inclusive. And I think that that is something that they have a lot in common with the Black Panther Party. Things that were wildly revolutionary acts in the moment are institutionalized and have created improvement in people's lives. I mean, it's an incremental approach, but, you know, it still does work. So, like, if you look at the progressive and recurring tax codes, adjusting tax codes local, state, and federal level, this is something that a broad coalition can come around.
Mm-hmm.
Like, restructuring formula to make sure, like, the funding formula for the way cities received aid or their fair share from the state and from the federal government was thrown completely off the rails during the Reagan years and the following years. Our Rhode Island legislator does not seem to care about the density of population inside the cities and expects urban homeowners and fee payers to take on the lion's share of the service that everyone in the state benefits from. So there does need to be a readjustment of that. Going in deep on that with real policy solutions, you know, like raising marginal income tax rates for high earners, removing caps on payroll tax that fund Social Security, which would completely make Social Security solvent forever, raising corporate income tax, which is something that has incredible currency here since we saw a decrease in income tax, corporate income tax in Rhode Island. Anti-speculation tax, land trust, increase of state tax, all these things are broad and are shared progressive labor values, right? We can all get behind this.
Mm-hmm.
We can, this is nothing here is so far outside the realm of the possible. The fact that it's scaled inside their policy position is remarkable. And the fact that there are policy solutions, like literal model language that's being offered, means that we're prepared to take it to that spot. And that's just in the economic justice part. In the criminal justice reform, or in community control in particular, well, actually, let's go to the more interesting one. The investiture and divestiture, this is something that everyone should be immediately behind. I mean, Samuel Gompers, noted racist, said that the reason for labor and the cause of labor is that we want less jails and more jobs. We want less war and more buildings. Like, the exact vision, like what we should think of is of what's possible. That is not outside of what is inside the invest-divest portion, right? Like relocation of federal and state funds, the local level, away from police incarceration into strategies like education and testing out restorative justice, which is something that was thought of. So, I mean, in the 70s, that was normal to think of abolition as part of the normal conversation about policing in prison. Asking for a constitutional right to education, I mean, that would alter everything. Particularly people, low-income, white and black people, would have much greater access. So like in Rhode Island, where we have, 27 separate school districts?
Mm-hmm.
That's 27 separate administrators, 27 separate bus systems, 27 separate contracts with food vendors. That is the least efficient possible system. That is one that, if it were altered, that would start to provide meaningful funding. Delinking educational funding from property taxes would be another thing that could happen. Divestment from fossil fuels. It's obviously something that needs to happen. Poor and black folks are on the spear tip of climate change. Environmental racism, what do they call it, corporate abandonment zones, whatever those things are, which are just polluted areas next to poor people in schools, affect working class and poor children at much higher rates than anyone else. That's something that could happen. It's not that far out. So I'm optimistic. And I think I can't stand the presidential elections because of the amount of distraction that they offer.
Exactly.
Whereas like all the real work that has to happen is like so much closer. And I'm not saying like presidential policy doesn't have an immediate and direct impact on people's lives. I mean, we spent 15 years at war because of the decisions of these boobs. And we're still suffering from the effects of the deregulation under Carter, of the trucking, all this stuff. Like, they affect our day-to-day lives in a very meaningful way, but school policy and funding formulas are decided at home. And the lift to actually do it is doable, but it will require like a social change in the majority population to start to accept people. Like, they will not have to be, they can no longer afford to be defensive about this.
Right.
And I think that's the major change, right?
Right.
So like, we can find this common ground on all this stuff, but I can tell you right now, where Barrington, East Greenwich are absolutely delightful places to live, if we were to say there's a funding firm that's going to have to shift, they're going to be affected by it. You know, in the Rhode Island Constitution, it says that the burdens for the benefit have to be shared by everybody. I think it's time that we lived up to that. And I think that the Black Lives Matter platform actually provides the groundwork to live up to our Constitution.
Right. So there's a story that I've been tracking in the entire year since it appeared in the Washington Post. And the headline was, "Donald Trump talked politics with Bill Clinton weeks before launching his 2016 bid." And one of the lines I'll read here, "Four Trump allies and one Clinton associate familiar with the exchange said that Clinton encouraged Trump's efforts to play a larger role in the Republican Party and offer his own views in the political landscape. It was only a casual chat." Later it says, "Trump took the call at his office in Trump Tower in New York," according to four people. You and I know that politicians really grasp the media as a tool and how to use it. And it seems to me that this was a very cynical phone call to make in that regard. Do you have any thoughts on that?
The cynicism of higher level politicians. Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that I find really, really difficult, this is like a hard needle to thread, is, inside union movement and inside the labor movement, we have a principle of negotiation, right? Like, we talk. We work, obviously, but sometimes that work is talking. Is that you sit down at the table with people who you know do not have your best interests at heart, and you have to actually talk to them, and you have to actually listen to every word they're saying, and you have to take into account and try to come to a common ground. And that's a tedious process that working class people are very adept at, but rich people are not. Mm-hmm. Rich people are adept at the tools for those sort of things. The thing that makes it difficult is that when I know that the decisions that get made affect, like, say, whatever the bargaining unit size is, are going to be either hurt people or actually hurt people, and then I see the person I was negotiating with, and not necessarily me, but they may talk to the lawyers or the people I've been working with, make it like they're part of the same club. Mm-hmm. And that even though these decisions are going to be destructive to some people, isn't it great that we can go play golf on Sunday? Isn't it great that we can do this sort of thing? And that level of intimacy is something that most working class people don't have access to. Most people of color don't have access to. Most women don't have access to. Most queer folks don't have access to. And that, even if it was a perfectly innocent conversation, is it appropriate? No. Is it likely to have been cynical? Absolutely. Do you think that these folks had our interests at heart? No. Yeah. I mean, I firmly believe that they can't see outside of their own survival. And I think that they, even in their concept of public service, it's only seen through the lens of somebody who lives inside Trump Tower or who could build a 30-story building in Harlem. Or who lives in Chappaqua or whatever that place that is in upstate New York, that if that's the collective they're trying to serve, then it sure looks like their own vision. Working people don't get that. Actually, that's not true. Working people have to have clearer eyesight than that. Like, we're able to see, we have to make connections to people. We can't pretend that we're independent. So Trump and Clinton meeting to have a policy discussion? Of course they did. Mm. Why wouldn't they?
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like they have access to each other. They both live in New York. I mean, they're a cab ride away. It's a 25-minute cab ride from each other. How hard could it be? I mean, you know, it's like I once did New York Metropolitan Opera is fantastic place to work. It's some of the best employment conditions on the face of the earth. Michelle Obama is on the board of directors of the Metropolitan Opera, and so are the Koch brothers.
Right.
I don't think that they are, they're definitely not friends. Like, I don't think, but that does mean that there is a level of social interaction that they have or will have or have the potential of having. So there's a chance for contact, which is something that working people have with each other that we don't have with the wealthy, and it's something that the wealthy pay not to have with working people. I don't think they can have our interests at heart. I think it's cynical. I think it's, even if they had the best intent, it's still cynical.
Yeah, and I mean, what jumps out to me in that story is Bill Clinton knew that his wife did not have the appeal that he has to voters. And I think we just saw that acted out brilliantly over the last year with the candidacy of Sanders coming out of nowhere. And, you know, it's about staging. It's about how you put it on the television screen. And if you put a Jeb Bush or a Marco Rubio or a Ted Cruz across from Hillary Clinton, that's a very different conversation than when you have a complete raving lunatic television star with no political history doing his whole song and dance, and then you have the former Secretary of State. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Paul Begala said, politics is show business for ugly people.
Yes.
Exactly. So it's got, and as somebody who has worked in show business for most of their lives, I don't think that this makes it less real. Like, I think that there is, the appeal to people's emotional sensibility. Like, folks vote, and folks, like, people always like to say, like, I go with my heart, and I go with my heart. They don't. They really don't. Folks act in what they perceive to be their best interest. Like, they are making real intellectual decisions. The show business aspect of it shows that you care in some ways. So, and also the thing somebody pointed out to me, like, I worked as a stage manager for a while, was that the way something is managed indicates how the leadership of the person in a lot of ways. So, like, I've worked for directors who were completely scattered. And the process was terrible. The art might have come out really wonderfully and they might have been brilliant, but getting to that point was terrible, absolutely terrible, and people hated each other, whatever. And then I've worked for real tyrants who demanded lots of pages and pages of notes and all this crap, and it was sometimes wonderful. The amount of organization it takes to run a show of that scale is significant. It's a lot of coordination. Depending on how this is a slightly different take on the whole thing. Depending on how well they can manage that indicates style and management ability. So somebody like Donald Trump, who, if you look at the actual show, or the Republican convention, for example, was amateurish start to finish. Like, everything about it. Like, I turned on the news feed or the live feed of it, and you could hear the stage manager calling out camera shots and yelling at his camera operators. I was like, this is the most unprofessional thing I've ever seen. I mean, it was terrible. Like, it was hokey in a lot of ways and not in a good, like, homey sort of way. Whereas the Democratic convention was run flawlessly, with excellent stage management, excellent stage skills, excellent timing. It was scripted beautifully. Like, as an example of organizational tightness and discipline and ability to get things done, the party that actually wants to govern versus the party that is against governing makes the point pretty clearly. So I actually value the show for that, sort of. I don't think it's as, I guess I don't think it's as outside, Bernie Sanders feels insurgent. And it does come out of nowhere, and he did say and do some wonderful things. But when he was getting up on in front of those crowds at those arenas, there was a crew of at least five or six riggers who hung in the lights and focused them on him. There was a sound engineer. There was somebody setting the mic. I mean, it was the same thing. It was just a different scale.
Right. Exactly. So there was a survey of key focus group findings with Obama surge voters, and they did a survey of Black voters who came out maybe for the first or second time only in 2008 and 2012 to vote for Obama as Black voters. And the results they're showing, it was carried in the New York Times maybe 2 days ago now. One of the quotes was, "What am I supposed to do if I don't like him and I don't trust her? I choose between being shot and being stabbed? No way." Another male Obama surge voter from Florida said, "I see why the Hispanics are scared of him because he is attacking their family. But I don't understand why I should be more scared than anybody else." And it goes on to show that the Black and brown youth vote has become extremely skeptical of Clinton due to the legacy of policies under her husband. And I wonder if you just have thoughts on that, because I find that aspect fascinating, of a generational divide, almost.
Yes, to all of that. There's never been, as far as I can tell, a candidate who has polled statistically zero with the African-American community, ever. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump is maybe the first to have ever done that. As far as the voter participation inside the African-American community, African-American women are the single most consistent voting bloc and most frequent voters in this country. They are the most reliable. They work the polls. They show up. They are a meaningful thing. Is there a generational divide? Yeah, absolutely. And there should be. Hillary Clinton is a difficult and deeply problematic candidate in so many ways that it can be really hard to make that vote. But at the same time, the things that affect folks in the working class and poor communities, there's a measure, like there's a real measure that gets made about who is going to be right and wrong. Like, I'd be willing to bet you that guy that said shot or stabbed,
that was a lady.
And again, what?
That was a lady who said that.
The lady who said, am I going to be shot or stabbed? She very well, I mean, she's right. I mean, that's a hard decision. But, you know, again, we're 60 days out, more or less. When she looks at and she talks to her family and she talks to other people in the community about, well, will Head Start maintain funding under Hillary, or will it get cut under Trump? Well, Hillary will maintain Head Start funding. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's one plus. Hillary has come out pretty aggressively against the Hyde Amendment, which allows working class women to reproductive health, which prevents working class women from getting access to reproductive health. That is hugely significant.
Right.
And that is, like, that, if there was a single issue to vote on, that very well may be the one. Is she a capitalist? Will she make neoliberal decisions? Will she support? Yes, absolutely. She has never been anything but this, kind of corporatist woman who is running for president, who's going to win. But there are things that are meaningfully different. And those things, when people make that measure right before they go into vote, they're going to make that decision based on those things. Like, Head Start is probably the most significant one that I can think of off the top of my head.
Right.
The likelihood of having it reduced to block grants, which is like the Republicans have been trying to do forever, is pretty high if Trump wins, if there's a Trump victory. If there's not, since she's made a pretty, for all her faults, she has consistently throughout her entire career argued for quality early childhood education as a place to start from, and championed early funding and strong funding of those programs. That alone is a solid vote, and I think that's ultimately going to be the deciding factor. In my family, and I think this, so, you know, I have a big family. In my family, when Obama was running, the narrative that played out nationally played out exactly in my family. It took a while for black voters to get behind Obama. Right. And folks seem to forget that a little bit.
South Carolina was the turning point.
Yeah, that there is a deeply deep pragmatism inside the black community when it comes to, or at least inside my family, that I needed to be convinced before I was going to cast a vote for him that, one, he could win, and two, if he won, he wasn't going to do any damage. And so that's a big lift. And this is a sweeping generalization, but it's based on my family, which there's a lot of members of my family, so I'm going to go with it. Black voters vote in collectives. There is no monolithic black vote. However, when black voters vote, we vote in a way that is inclusive of, generationally inclusive and socially inclusive. So it's, even if it's something that may not be immediately good for us today, we think about what it's going to be like 2 years down the line, right? Mm-hmm. Or what the next vote is going to be. And I think that kind of makes the African-American community, based on my family, a little bit different than the way white voters are perceived in, or the white voting bloc is perceived, where it has to appeal to a direct transactional moment.
Right.
And for the African-American community, it's not a transactional moment. The stabbed or shot thing, legitimate, meaningful, and that's real talk coming from her. But at the end of the day, when she gets into the voting booth, if she's in a swing state, the likelihood of her voting strategically is really, really high.
Right.
And that becomes a thing, right? So, like, among some of my friends or my cousins anyway, we're talking about Jill Stein maybe 2 weeks ago. And one of them said, well, Jill Stein has kind of a squirrely message on vaccines. And that did it. That was the end of Jill Stein.
Mm-hmm.
As a family who survived, was ravaged by polio, and a lot of black folks have experience with since access to medical care was low, that's a deal breaker, right? So she's a non-existent candidate at that point.
Right.
And so that vote is gone to her. That other groups can see things in a different way is lucky for them. You know, like, well, she's good on the environment. The vaccine thing is kind of stupid, but I'm still going to go for the environment. It's people who didn't experience pain or death based on communicable diseases, right? So we make those decisions based on those kind of more pragmatic metrics than I think other groups do.
Right.
We're better voters.
So one of the things that fascinated me this year about the Trump base was, you know, he just kind of strung together sentences from Twitter and Facebook and blogs that he was reading that morning, and he didn't really have anything coherent to say, but his base reacted to six or seven different policy positions that, in objective thinking, if it were any other candidate, he would be getting huge applause from the other side of the aisle too, and progressive votes, because he said he opposes the TPP, wants to renegotiate NAFTA, wants to get rid of NATO, which is really the kind of vanguard of the military-industrial complex. He wants to expand Social Security, and, you know, he wanted to get rid of Common Core, and so...
He's running as a populist, right?
Yeah, and I mean, the fact his base exploded and went nuts for things like that demonstrated that in a post-electoral landscape, there's a place for meaningful coalitions around those issues. And I do admit and acknowledge that part of that would include a lot of very deep conversations about chauvinism in all its nasty forms. But I mean, you've got a background in the left. What do you think of a wider, broad-based kind of united front from below taking on some of these issues after the election?
Okay, well, so what's the motivation for it, though? I think that's the question I come to when, you know, you see Trump saying, like, I'm going to expand Medicare, yet all his policy advisors are people that want to privatize.
Right. Right. That's separated from the fact his base went exploded for it and showed...
Right. So, I guess what... I don't really care about his motivation.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to say that. I got distracted by something else. He's going to say that because he knows it works, right? He's talking to... He can read his demographic. When he looks at his base, he's looking at himself. Mm-hmm. And when the base looks at him, they are looking at a version of themselves that they wish, the aspirational version of themselves. Like, here's a guy who is clearly not that bright, who, you know, if I were born in his position, I would be just like him. Yeah. And you know what? They're probably right. Let's go back to the organized working class population. Like, let's look at folks who are in unions who pay dues. One of the reasons that labor supports Social Security so deeply and has supported right from the beginning was not necessarily because my membership or I would get paid by Social Security. It's
right.
That the principle of solidarity was the one that is the overarching goal of Social Security. That's like the foundational thought in a lot of ways of all of the social safety nets that came up was not that it was going to be me, but that it was going to be my neighbor.
Right.
And so that's the motivation for African-American support of Social Security. I mean, technically, statistically, African-American men should not support Social Security at all. They should, in many ways, support the abolition of Social Security, since most African-American men don't live long enough to collect meaningfully from Social Security. So, which accounts for a huge wealth transfer, yet... We do support Social Security because we want we don't want our neighbors to starve to death,
mm-hmm.
even if we're not going to be the recipients of it.
Right.
And the fact that we're not going to be recipients is another problem that needs to be addressed, but Social Security doesn't solve that problem. So I support my neighbors. When you see the Trump electorate scream for something like an increase in Social Security, they're thinking of themselves.
Right.
And that motivation is an unsustainable motivation for supporting something like Social Security, which is dependent on the idea of a collective good, collective need solved by a collective good. If you support Social Security because you want it, that's a very different place to come from. And I don't know, I think that there's a basic values difference there. And I don't think that coalitions can be built where there's really divergent value systems. I think there can be alliances built around it. I think that there can be sort of strategic alliances built around it, but I don't think that there can be meaningful coalition, because the motivation is, if I work in coalition, I want my partners to be winning.
Right.
But if the actual process of victory is just transactional for me winning, then as soon as I win, I walk away from the table.
Yeah, I mean, part of that has to be also geographically, because a lot of this base exists in the non-union right to work states. And so mentality.
Right. So, And I think that there's a couple of really interesting ways that we can look at that. So So, like, if you look at something like the Earned Income Tax Credit, which are really a good, like, a good, meaningful thing, even though in a lot of ways it has a problem. And the problem is that an Earned Income Tax Credit is necessary because of the amount of fees, taxes, and low wages that are paid to working people. Right? So, like, the solution isn't necessarily an Earned Income Tax Credit. That's a solution to an issue inside of a larger problem. The problem is that wages, conditions, inflation, fees, and taxes on working people are so burdensome that they cannot survive without an earned income tax credit. Mm-hmm. Right. So an organized worker has a pension, or should have a pension, or some sort of defined benefits plan that they're going to retire on, in which case Social Security doesn't become or shouldn't become the central issue. It shouldn't become the most necessary thing. And that one of the arguments that come from labor, and as it should come from labor, is that workers should be organizing into collective bargaining agreements in order to have a sustainable, secure future in their old age. Part of that survival should be Social Security, but it shouldn't be the central point of survival. So, like, if you look at right-to-work states, you see more and more elderly folks fully dependent on Social Security for survival, and we all know that that's impossible. Mm-hmm. So, it's like if you have a transactional view of it, then not only is it unsustainable, you are putting off a necessary confrontation with your employer.
Right.
And that's what I want to see.
So what I've been proposing in different ways over the last couple of months is a concrete example. Could you see yourself getting involved with a boycott of something like Walmart, which is anti-union, and we know the whole song and dance about what their policy and attitude towards labor organizers has always been. And we also know the impact they have on small business owners who see their shuttered businesses within 5 years of a Walmart going up. There's a very sizable constituency of people out there, if you think of it in a term that isn't based around as much traditional 20th century paradigms of labor and management.
Walmart is already actively boycotted by the AFL Federation, both nationally and locally. There is no AFL Federation in the country that is not part of a Walmart boycott. Mm-hmm. That has been an ongoing process. Do I think the thesis of the question that small business is better?
My point would be to put in priority the big box, which is kind of like the central annex of neoliberalism's ravaging of local economies in comparison to small businesses.
Yeah, all right, I got it. Yes, Walmart exists only because of certain really shitty national trade policy. Like, industries like that are impossible to maintain if they don't have pro-business shipping contracts, subsidized fuel, subsidized or some sort of supported active trade policy that is actually yelling for them. If they don't have free and open access to factories overseas and the labor conditions of the workers inside those factories, which is something that for most of history in the most of history in the world was something that was reserved to very, very few businesses had access to that sort of thing. Supposedly, in the new world, everyone has access to that sort of thing. So there's that. I don't think so. For the boycott of Walmart to be meaningful, there has to be a meaningful alternative to Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, like, the grape, you know, like, if you look back at, like, the specific boycotts, or, like, we're going after grapes, you had other food to go to. Walmart has cornered the market in a lot of communities for very, very necessary items. And because of that, working people and poor folks in general and working class people in general, it's the only option.
Right.
It can be the only supermarket. It can be the only clothing store. It can be the only drugstore for hundreds of miles around or dozens of miles around. In which case, a boycott is not a meaningful.
You would have to create a discount club to help those folks in the small business.
Yeah, you'd have to come up with some other solution. So, and one of those solutions may very well be, and I think it's something that people should be more creative about, is so right now Medicare can't negotiate rates of compensation from their suppliers, their drug suppliers or vendors, et cetera. So anyone can bill whatever they want. They bill Medicare everything, and then we pay it. Like, that's our thing. If Medicare, which is, I think, the single largest purchaser of medical supplies and drugs in the country, had a free hand, if they were able to use free market principles and negotiate rates, then you would see places like Walmart change drastically,
right,
quickly. So in which case, Walmart may not be as a target. I mean, the Walton family are just brutal capitalists, of which we have always lived with brutal capitalists. If we can bend back some of the fangs of the capitalism by either changing policy for drug reimbursement, maybe that would be it. Maybe that would be something that took one of their teeth out, tied up one of the legs of the octopus, or however, whatever metaphor you want to use for it. And that may be the more reasonable solution. Or maybe buyers' co-ops being the people we are a buyer's co-op and we're going to negotiate directly with Walmart. I mean, I don't know. Like, I think that the creative possibility hasn't been there, hasn't really been explored yet, because I think that we're still trapped in some organizing models that were written in the 30s and 40s, and I don't think we've explored what the future actually looks like.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. Not saying we should abandon some of those things, but I think we need to be a little bit more open to them.
Yeah, I mean, everything needs an update.
Right. So the only people that are really adept at updating really consistently tends to be the capitalist class. They are excellent at coming up with some new shit to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like they just hire teams and teams. Oh, wait, they do hire teams and teams of people just to create new ways of extracting wealth from working people.
Right.
And I think Walmart has become adept at doing that. They've created a lose-lose cycle and with an expanding market at the same time. I mean, that's an amazing triumph for a brutalist group, right? So I don't know. Like, I don't think a boycott would be, because there's no, so one of the problems with the boycott also is that if somebody is forced to, I spent $80 on school supplies for Xavier this year. We got this huge list of shit that we had to deliver to the school for him to be able to go to school. It's public school. Things that used to have been paid for by the public school, like tissues. Eroding tax base means that the schools can't afford those things, so now the parents have to buy them, but that's a lot of money. Mm. And that means you're going to go to the cheapest place that has them, which, I mean, my family can't, but other families may go to Walmart, which by their own policy erodes the tax base, sucks out supplies to the school, then the parents have to go to Walmart to keep this kind of cycle going. To create, to inject either guilt or shame into that cycle would be destructive.
Right. It's a tough question, I know.
Yeah. So I'm optimistic about, again, this is something that I'm always going to be optimistic about, is that workers are incredibly creative when it comes to fighting back against things. They, you know, because of our goodwill in general, we take a lot. But I think there comes a moment when we hit a critical mass and thought changes a little bit, and it just takes a slight readjustment of focus.
Right.
We've been hammered for a long time with a vision of the world that's seen through the lens of people like Donald Trump. I mean, to tell you, even if it wasn't specifically him, even the liberal versions of him, we still see the world through the lens of acquisition and wealth and growth. And I think that we're starting to sort of scrape our eyes away from that sort of thing. That, you know, like the Black Lives Matter movement and Occupy and, you know, kind of like the burgeoning environmental movements that we're seeing around the world, indigenous movements around the world, we're seeing a more concerted critique come out. And I think that inside labor's ranks, we're also seeing a more concerted critique. Sometimes it has to be symbolic initially, but it is something that is ongoing. So like at the last national AFL convention, so national AFL conventions look kind of the way you would imagine they would look, right? Like there's a huge dais. The president sits at the very top of this huge kind of pyramid where the hierarchy is actually physically represented. So you have the president, the secretary treasurer, armies and vice presidents, organizing departments. And then you have union leadership from the locals who in this context become rank and file. It's intimidating. It's like to make a presentation at something like that, you have to walk to the central microphone and challenge something, which can be really hard to do. And it's something that takes a lot of stamina and courage to kind of get through. At the last convention, they eliminated that physical structure. So the presidents and vice presidents, secretary treasurers were all on the floor with everybody else. And they invited community and civil rights organizations to come participate in the convention as active participants. This is a structural change that was relatively quiet, but indicates a much larger shift that's happening. And it's something that I think is going to translate into real, meaningful, long-term change. I mean, for the first time, I've seen unions from around the world come and address working people in the United States as brothers and sisters.
Right.
That's new to me.
Right.
And so, that is a dramatic change.
Mm-hmm. So let's slightly pivot into labor, which is a major political force in Rhode Island. In the last year and a half, we've seen several projects come up where labor has locked horns with community activists over different projects, and one that jumps to my mind immediately is the baseball stadium when they wanted to build it in Providence, and now there's still conversation about subsidies going to do a renovation of McCoy Stadium. And there's the point that jumps out to me is that these baseball projects and major sports stadiums have always been engines of gentrification, you know. So where is the place that the community needs to be coming to the table at labor and basically be making an exchange? Because this does comes down to basically, you know, instead of this, why not this?
Yeah, that's true. And it's a difficult spot to be in. So I think one of the things that happens is there are 80,000, I guess actually according to the last count, which I don't believe it, there are 65,000 union members in Rhode Island. That's a lot. Mm-hmm. Most of them are married, most of them have kids. So, like, if you expand what, like, a union household, then you're looking at maybe 12 or 15% of the population are going to be in that fold, in which case that's a community. And that community has a voice, and they're not separate from any other community. So, you know, that's kind of what cards on the table part. Then there's the thing that a union's membership or a union's leadership is immediately answerable to its membership. And I think specifically in the trade unions, leadership tends to come from the rank and file. And there's a level of access and intimacy with the membership that is, one, practically sacred, but also really, really, really valuable. And the leader has to have a long, long view of the union and what the union's going to be doing. So, like, for when I was with the stagehands, the union had been around for 130 years. Right. So looking at a single project, you had to look at it in this kind of generational scope. Be like, does that increase our position tomorrow or 5 years from here? Does it increase membership? Does it increase dues? Does it stabilize the institution? So there's that. When members come to a meeting and if there's no defined seniority, or there's no defined trade work, or if it's like labor, you know what I mean? They will, when the discussion comes up about new work and stuff like that, they will yell at the leader and they will take him to task for making a decision that jeopardized their rent or their ability to pay tuition to a school or whatever. And that is something that, as a rank and file member who's been elevated into leadership, you remember being that person. And so it's not like their decisions are being made ever in a vacuum. They're being responsible to the practical democracy of their organization. And that is really, 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 really important to remember, that it's not decisions made in like a star chamber. These are long discussions that happen in union meetings all around the state between stewards and rank and file and presidents and rank and file and brothers and sisters with each other and brothers and sisters with their wives and their husbands and their kids about what it means. And I think that there's a huge amount of fear about what the future holds. So all that is true. Then you have this added thing where we have this conflicting idea about what has to happen, right? So a builder has to build in order to be a builder. Like, if they stop building, they're not a builder anymore. So building trades need building, and they need pretty constant building to keep, one, their membership going, but also that's what we do. There was a time in the country when we spent 4% of our GDP on public works projects.
Right.
Now we spend less than 0.5%.
Right.
Because of the decisions that some members, some communities made about how they want to or not want to pay taxes, or how their elected officials want to or not want to pay taxes. That erosion has made working people fight for smaller and smaller dollars than they had ever fought for before. And I think that's what it comes down to. For the community to be like really, like the broader, the non-labor community to be meaningful about this, they're going to have to be realistic about what they pay in property taxes and what they pay in what their community's contribution is to the rest of the state, or do they participate in the rest of the state, or do they value children, or do they value roads, or do they value police? Like, right now, the argument is that our legislator and our folks value a very, very small percentage of people who can profit very greatly from relatively incremental changes to tax policy that have devastating effects on working people. And that means working folks have to fight over things like stadiums instead of fighting over things like flood remediation or fixing the hurricane barrier or cleaning up the harbor around India Point Park or all these really kind of massive projects that need to go on. Like, we have every school could be refit, not just East Greenwich and Barrington, but that means that the people of East Greenwich and Barrington will have to commit to admitting that they live in a society that's shared.
Mm-hmm.
That would do it. That might help. That's
yeah.
A start.
Right.
But, you know, so it's, then you look at a place like Burrville, right, where you have this Invenergy project. And there's like there's a series of different arguments that can be made for them to have that project. All of them are pretty solid, right? Like, I mean, you can argue that we need to get away from fossil fuels, which is fine, and everyone acknowledges that, and we all know that. But you do have to offer a meaningful funding framework for an alternative to that. Otherwise, there's no meaningful conversation. And then you have to factor in the fact that so many of the people who work in the building trades come from urban communities inside Rhode Island, where they've borne the brunt of industrialization and borne the brunt of pollution and borne the brunt of all the stuff, that saying, like, maybe if the burden were shared, it wouldn't be so hard on us. And that's a legitimate argument. You know, like, you're looking at a fairly monochromatic community up against a not so monochromatic working class in that case. And that is that's a pretty stark thing.
Right. And it's a very hard conversation. Do you think that labor is in the position where they can be demanding the transition to alternative energy? I mean, a jobs program where they put solar panels on municipal buildings and houses.
Well, so the governor made a promise for that, you know, and then it becomes down to a matter of tax policy then. And I think people need to be, or the state and constituents need to be more creative when it comes to that. So, like, right now we have a tax credit system that has very little attachment to it, as far as employment metrics or green anything. And yet the governor made a commitment to retrofitting state buildings and et cetera. You could have a green aspect to a tax stabilization agreement or to a tax credit agreement that said, well, if you're going to build X, Y, or Z, then you must have X, Y, and Z to a renewable resource that is accessible and buildable here.
Mm-hmm.
Another option for labor is, and one that I think is starting to be explored, even though traction is slow on this, is that the majority of construction that happens now, and this wasn't always true, is housing construction, which is a significantly wasteful, it's also largely unorganized place, is establishing green cooperatives that are made up of organized workers. I mean, that is something that's being discussed actively in a lot of different circles inside labor's leadership. And I think that is a pretty promising place, right? But, you know, I mean, I'm going to tell you a short story that kind of puts it in the nutshell for me. Right. So I was working on a movie, and it was the middle of winter. And in order for our hydraulics to work on the truck, we had to keep the truck idling throughout the day. And this woman comes out of it. We're on the east side. And this woman comes out of a giant, opens her garage, gets in her car, and then yells at the driver of the truck. She's like, "You are destroying my plan. And how dare you, you know, you turn off your engine right now." And the driver of the truck just calmly, this is, you know, working class guy from Nonsocket, looks at her and says, "I live in a 500 square foot house. I have one car. I did not take a vacation to Europe. I have two children. You have four. I see little stickers on the back of your car. I don't have a heated garage. And I don't have a summer house. my carbon footprint and the footprint of this truck is significantly smaller than yours.
Right.
Working people know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when, depending on which voice the environmentalist is, they're choosing to use or center that day, that becomes the immediate pushback, right? Like, well, if you didn't have, you know, buy a new computer every 2 years, if you're more economical with X, if you didn't buy on a flood zone, if you didn't do this, if you didn't take a vacation to Bimini every year or whatever, we wouldn't be as bad off as we are now.
Right.
So don't put it on working people.
Right. Are there any other points you want to make about either the black vote or the labor vote or the black laboring voter?
All black folks are labor folks. I don't know. I just can't wait till the election's over.
Yeah.
I hate elections.
I hate it too.
I mean, it's like it's a collective effort that's reduced to like this kind of shamefully private act. I think it shouldn't be like that.
It slightly reminds me of Easter duty.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. So, I guess I'm excited that there seems to be, like, a new, better working... Oh, there's a new willingness to talk among different communities right now, and I'm really excited about that. So I'm pretty optimistic, but I don't know. The election's the election.
Yep.
I just hope for a less racist legislator next year.
Yeah, I'm going to stop.
Thank you for listening today, and please tune in for other episodes of this series as they are released by the Rhode Island Media Cooperative. You can follow along through our Facebook page or on Twitter via @RIMediaCoop.